Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Story time.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I worked nights as a park ranger for a fairly urban city that had a variety of small to medium-sized parks I was tasked with patrolling, the largest being around 80 acres, but being in an urban area, mostly consisted of removing people sleeping in their cars after sunset, as all the parks were fenced and had to be locked at night. I'd say about 90% of the time, I came across a car belonging to someone down on their luck, just looking for a safe place to sleep in their car. Had a lot of sympathy for those people, but unfortunately, my job was centered around keeping the surrounding parks empty at night and had to be the asshole telling them to leave or sleep somewhere else. The other 10% of cars I'd come across had a distinct fog to their windows that meant one of two things. Either they were smoking weed or getting it on. I had a very loud intercom inside my patrol car that brought me great joy when rolling up on unsuspecting lovers engaging in a little car fun and watching them scramble to get decent. I know dick move, but it was one of the few bits of excitement I had of the otherwise long and monotonous nights. The oddest and most memorable, however, I had traded the night for a day shift, which weirdly enough had its fair share of foggy windows as well. I went to check a parking lot behind a rec center that often had people trying to stay out of sight for good reason, and noticed one lone car with the classic window fog. As I approached their vehicle, I noticed an older man having his own fun in the bushes within arm's length of the car window. Older dude outside the car takes off at the sight of my car, and I say on my intercom, "Put your clothes on, can't do that here." To my surprise, the young couple came up to my car after dressing to apologize, and I tell them to grab their friend that ran away and to leave the park. Their eyes widen and didn't understand what I meant by friend. I had to explain to this couple no older than 25 that there was an older male, quote, self-pleasuring, while peeping into their window, and I was not kidding. They were both mortified. I went to look for the older guy, but at this point he had fled the park. I reported the incident, but nothing much to go off other than a rough description of what he looked like, and the two lovers didn't want to stick around for a police report. I never saw the couple or the guy in the park again. A bunch of guys came running into the ranger station, carrying their buddy with his pants partially pulled down or up, and was bleeding because his buddies had dared him to sit on a barrel cactus, and of course he had about 10-15 needles in his butt. We were 25 minutes to the nearest town and about 2 hours from the nearest hospital. The town had a rotating doctor at an urgent care center, but really equipped to handle something like this. So we had to call in a medevac helicopter to pick him up. His buddies were freaking out. I thought this story might be of interest to some people. I promise this is all genuine. I've done my best to limit embellishments and tell everything factually. This did happen 10 years ago, so I'm a little fuzzy on some of the details, but I've noted that where necessary. So when I was 15 way back in 26, my best friend Michelle, her parents James and Laura, and some family friends Janet and Trevor invited my friend Emma and I to spend a week with them at this place called Grindel's Hut. Grindel's Hut is a cottage in the middle of the Volcathunha Gammon Ranges National Park, about 7 hours' drive from Adelaide, the capital city of South Australia. It's actually a cottage next to a tiny hut built by stockman John Grindel back in the early 19s. More on him later. Her family had stayed there a few times and said it was absolutely stunning. One place they were really keen to revisit was Bunyip Chasm. The photos I've seen look amazing. Unusually colored rocks, ferns, and waterfalls all around this narrow chasm deep in the bushland. Again, more on that later. That far north, it's all dirt roads. We were driving a 4WD station wagon, rugged car, but didn't have much clearance. While Janet and Trevor drove a Land Rover, which was far more ideal for the terrain. It was the middle of winter, so heavy rains had turned large sections of road into muddy slip-end slides, and a few creeks along the way had flooded, covering the roads. We managed to get as far as Igawarta, this brilliant Aboriginal cultural center or campsite run by the Inyamathana people. The park ranger came through and said the road ahead was almost unpassable and they had to close it for safety, so we decided to rent a couple of cabins at Igawarta and wait for the roads to dry up. I'm so glad we did because it was honestly one of the best experiences of my life. During the day, we went on bush walks to cave painting sites, and at night there'd be a big bonfire where we'd sing songs and hear traditional stories. Some of it was a bit trying, though. On the first night, a bus full of Aboriginal foster kids rocked up. We were told by their teachers or carers that they were all problem children who had been in the foster system for a while, constantly being handed on by families who couldn't handle them. We did feel really sorry for them. They'd clearly had hard lives, but in all honesty, for the most part, they were horrid little shits. These kids were all 7-12 years old, constantly screaming, fighting and using swear words I'd never consider using even now, and they were not afraid of anyone. They completely vandalized the public areas of the campsite, trashed the games room, and broke the latticing off of a rotunda. The camp staff were surprisingly cool about it. I expected them to go ballistic. They sat all the kids down and told them off, obviously, but the kids just laughed. However, despite being little hooligans, they did still have an appreciation for country and Aboriginal culture. One of the stories were learnt around the campfire that first night was about an evil spirit man. He or it had a name, but I have no idea how to spell it. We all learnt about him in a fun little song written by one of the elders. The lyrics were about walking home at night and having the spirit man following you so you start running away or he'll curse you. Typing that out, it's actually super creepy, but somehow the song was still fun and a bit silly. That first night, none of us got much sleep because the kids were all up screaming and carrying on, but the next day they got taken out on a private bush walk with some of the elders, and they came far more solemn. I was taken aback. They told us that they'd learnt secret things they couldn't tell us white fellas, and all of a sudden, they didn't think the evil spirit man was so funny anymore. That night, they were all quite well behaved. A few tried staying up late and being silly, but the rest would shush them up, saying the spirit man would come. They seemed genuinely afraid. The change in their behavior was so noticeable, I started to get a little worried myself. One of the Adnyamathanha people's most important stories is about the rainbow serpent Akira, who is responsible for creating the land and animals. The story talks about how Akira came down from the ranges to drink all the water in Lake Frome before returning to rest in Bunyip Chasm. This was really interesting to us because Bunyip Chasm was on the top of our list of places to visit. Now, as most people would know, the Aboriginal people are deeply connected to their country, and there are often many sacred places that need to be respected or treated with care. For the Adnyamathanha people, Bunyip Chasm is one of them. I'm ashamed to say I don't know the traditional name for the site. We ended up spending 3 days at Igawarta. When we left, we mentioned that we wanted to visit Bunyip Chasm, and the staff got a little funny about it. Again, it's a sacred site, and they take that seriously, as we should have too. They advised us not to go there, but if we did, to be careful. Honestly, the more I think about it, the more frustrated I am that we didn't listen. We're all very open-minded people. Michelle's parents border on being hippies, so we greatly respect Aboriginal culture, but obviously not enough to stop us going to one of their scared places. Anyway, on we traveled to our original destination, Grindel's Hut. Now, Grindel's Hut is the most remote place I have ever been to in my life. There is nothing out there but endless bushland. I honestly can't describe it in a way that isn't wanky, but there is just something about such ancient, untouched Australian bushland that is deeply moving. It feels so empty, but also so incredibly full of life and energy. It can honestly be a little overwhelming if you open yourself up to it. I nearly had a panic attack when I spent too long thinking about how far away from anything we were. The only building nearby is the ranger station. We stopped in there to collect the key and register ourselves. You have to let them know where you're going or what you're doing, and when you'll return in case something happens and they have to come find you. Again, we mentioned we planned to go to Bunyip Chasm. Apparently, when Michelle's family had last been through it, was fairly well advertised as a popular hiking trail or place of interest, but we saw almost nothing about it on our way up. The ranger said they decided to stop advertising it because there had been quite a few accidents. Obviously curious, we asked her more about it. Just a few more background details here to help paint the picture. The chasm is a few kilometers up from Grindel's Hut. To get there, you drive your car to the end of a dirt track to a place called Loch Ness Wellspoopy. Then you have to walk about 3 hours up a gorge through the creek bed until you finally reach a dead end with only a narrow path through. This is the beginning of the chasm. I think you used to be able to just walk in, but now there was a big boulder blocking the entrance. Apparently, this doesn't deter people, and most of them manage to climb over the boulder and get in. So obviously, when scrambling over rocks is involved there, going to be some injuries. First, there were a few sprains, a cracked wrist here and there, then a broken leg that required the rangers to go in and carry the person out. I vaguely recall hearing about a death at some point, but I'm reluctant to say that's a fact. Because of all these injuries, they decided to try and make it safer by putting proper ladders in. Two tradies went in, and while they were drilling holes to install the ladder, one of them slipped and cracked his skull. That was when it was decided it wasn't worth the risk, and they stopped advertising it. The ladder was never installed. Michelle's parents are highly optimistic people, so they only found all this curious while my friends and I were quietly apprehensive. Echoing the staff at Igawarta, the ranger recommended that we not go there at all, but if we did, to be careful. The main access to Grindel's Hut is via a 4WD track around the gorge that surrounds it, but it hadn't been graded recently, and since the wagon didn't have enough clearance to make it through, we left it at the ranger station, loaded all our supplies into the Land Rover, and Janet and Trevor drove in while we made the 11-kilometer approximately trek through the gorge. Just even more evidence as to how extremely isolated this place is. We finally make it to the cottage when the rain's coming again. After all the hiking, we were glad to just stay indoors and read for a day or two. So this was when we learnt the unsettling backstory of the location. So as I said, the cottage you stay in is built in front of the original hut, which is horribly dilapidated and super creepy, now built by cattle farmer John Grindel in 1918. Several mysterious incidences had occurred there. I can't remember the full story, but roughly John's cattle began disappearing. His mule was killed, then one of the men he hired to help him muster the cattle one year went missing and was found to be murdered. Grindel was convicted and jailed, but spared hanging. Apparently Grindel's ghost has been seen around the old hut, which, having seen the hut, I do not doubt in the slightest. But aside from getting the creeps from the old hut, I never experienced anything personally. By the time the rain cleared up and we finally set out for the chasm, I was more creeped out by the hut than all the warnings we'd been given. The walk up the creek bed was beautiful. The rains meant it was flowing in most places, so we had to rock hop for a fair bit of it, which was fun. There were frogs, birds, and kangaroos about. Absolutely ideal hike. About halfway along, we came across another group. They were staying at the campsite back near the ranger station and had driven in specifically to visit the chasm. Despite it not being heavily advertised, the chasm is still quite well known via word of mouth. We stopped and chatted to them for a bit, and they told us they didn't end up making it to the chasm because their youngest boy started feeling ill and they decided to turn back. We wished them the best and carried on. After that, the hike started feeling different. It was probably a combination of the ever-growing cliffs looming over us and the warnings creeping back into my mind, but I no longer felt welcome. Now I know it's just a feeling, but being welcome to a place is very important in Aboriginal culture, otherwise you can upset the spirits who will play tricks on you or try to hurt you. We were almost at the end of the creek bed, about 500 meters away from the chasm, when Trevor, the family friend, slipped on the rocks and twisted his back. It wasn't too bad, he could continue on, but being an older man, and that far away from help, it was a bit of a worry. Trevor's injury slowed our pace a little, but we finally made it to the opening of the chasm. The opening was around 2 meters wide, and exactly as the ranger described, right in the middle, was a large boulder about 3 m tall. It was much bigger than I expected and completely smooth, nothing really to grab onto. Making it even more inaccessible was the large dirty pond at the base of it. Despite the recent rain, it didn't look like fresh water. It had that dark brown color and had obviously been sitting stagnant for a while. Leaning across the pond against one side of the boulder was a decent-sized log. Someone had clearly put it there to use as a kind of ramp to help climb over. Michelle's dad was the first to try. The log looked worn and was slightly damp from yesterday's rain. He slipped slightly and almost got to the top when it cracked, and he fell into the pond. The pond is full of rocks, so he got pretty badly bruised. The log crumbled down next to him. By this point, I was certain we were not supposed to get into the chasm. The place basically had a do not enter sign on it. Something didn't want us there, but the adults were determined. We'd come this far. We looked all around for different options to help us in. More rocks, another log, but there was absolutely nothing. Finally, Michelle's dad gave her mom a boost up onto the boulder. She's a tall lady and only just made it up. From on top of the boulder, she sighed. Apparently there must have been a rock slide, and the inside of the chasm had filled with rock debris, making it very difficult to get through. It was decided that even if we all managed to get over the boulder, it wasn't safe to continue on, especially with Trevor's back and Michelle's dad now bruised and soaking wet. I was slightly disappointed, but also quietly relieved. The mood had completely changed. Everyone was a little sullen, and with the sun beginning to set, the gorge seemed gloomy and foreboding. Coupled with the unwelcome feeling, I think we were all ready to head back. Then, not 300 meters from the chasm, Emma suddenly tripped and sprained her ankle. I couldn't believe it. We had been warned that there had been accidents, but we didn't even get into the chasm, and we had already had 3 ourselves. Emma is prone to the dramatic, so I thought she was hamming it up, but it turned out she was actually quite hurt and couldn't walk unsupported. The car was 3 hours away, and it was getting late, so our only option was to take turns supporting her as we walked out. The walk back was grim. You know, that feeling like someone is standing right behind you. It felt like that for the longest time. Michelle and I started singing to entertain ourselves, mainly Disney songs, because we're dorks, and that really seemed to change the mood. It was probably just a mentality thing, but the general feel of the gorge seemed to lift a little, Maybe whatever forces were around respond well to singing. I don't know. When we got back to the car, it was almost sunset and the wind had picked up. That was our last night at the cottage and probably also the creepiest. The wind didn't let up all night, whistling around the cottage. Trevor almost had an asthma attack. He'd left his medication at home, but luckily I had an inhaler with me. He kept thanking me the rest of the trip. A potential attack in the middle of nowhere is pretty freaking scary, I guess. The next morning we packed up. Emma's ankle was still buggered, but since we had eaten most of the food we'd brought in, we managed to create a space for her in the Land Rover so she didn't have to walk out. Michelle, her parents, and I set off back through the gorge to the ranger station. After a week of hiking and exploring, we were pretty done, so everyone was fairly quiet on the walk home. Michelle and I, being younger and slightly fitter, ended up a little way ahead of her parents. We had just reached the top of a small hill at one end of the gorge when something made one of the weirdest sounds I've ever heard. Now Australian animals make weird noises. Cockatoos sound like bloody pterodactyls. But we're all outdoorsy nature people, so we know most animal noises when we hear them. The closest sound I can match it to is a camel's bellow, but with a small shriek at the end. There are feral camels in Australia, but they're mainly up north. It could have been a feral goat, but we had goats at school, and it didn't sound like that. It was quite loud and echoed down the gorge, so it stopped us in our tracks. We looked around for a sign of whatever had made the noise, but we saw nothing. We ran back to Michelle's parents, and they'd heard it too. They agreed it was weird and couldn't say what might have made it, but being as chilled as ever, they weren't really fussed about it. It was so odd. Just one single cry, like someone yelling, "And stay out," before slamming the door on you. That was an amazing trip. I learned and experienced so much. But the biggest thing I took away from it was to always respect Indigenous culture. I'm not at all religious and only vaguely spiritual, but I completely believe that the Aboriginals are connected to the land on a level we will never understand. They know things, and if they say not to go somewhere, it's in your best interest to listen. Being from the Navajo Nation, I have seen a lot of crazy things. Anyone not from here is most likely not to believe me. I have stories about skinwalkers, Ketchinadals coming to life, Bigfoot, werewolves, and some type of winged beast. But I think the most creepy is one of my skinwalker stories. So this story takes place in the early 2000s when I was a teenager. My cousin had just had a baby and her husband was called out for a job that would take a couple of weeks. My cousin asked if I would stay with her for 2 weeks to help her with the baby or work around the house. I was there for a few days and everything was pretty uneventful until the middle of the second week. At night we would hear someone knocking on different sides of the trailer. Keep in mind, the nearest neighbor was about 5 miles away. This continued for 3 nights in a row. The fourth night is when things take a turn for the worse. The night starts with the knocking, but it progresses to scratching. Worried that someone was trying to break in, I summoned the courage to go outside and confront whatever or whoever was messing with us. I only caught a shadow of whatever it was as it ran behind the trailer. I ran around yelling at it, "You better run because I'm going to call the cops," or something to that extent. It was so fast I could not believe it. As I chase it to the front of the trailer, it runs through the clothesline. This is where it gets even crazier. It ran towards the utility post and climbed up it, clutching something in its hands, and began the most eerie laugh I have ever heard. It jumps back down, dropping whatever it was holding, and runs toward the window of the trailer, as if to peek in. My cousin was inside holding the baby. I ran to the window and looked, and to my amazement, it had disappeared. I run inside and tell my cousin it is gone. Needless to say, we didn't sleep well for the rest of the night. The next morning I go outside and look at the window where I had last seen it. I looked at the ground and saw bare footprints, however. These were no ordinary footprints. The best way I can describe it was a human footprint with claws like a dog or wolf. I went to the utility pole and found what it had been clutching the night before. It was my niece's tiny little shirt. It goes without saying we spent the next few days in the safety of my mother's home off the res. All right, so my day was already off as it was. I woke up late after another long night of drinking with some colleagues. I was just barely getting into my truck when I got the call that there were some reports of somebody suspicious in one of our more remote campgrounds. I was called to investigate a suspicious person sighting. I was only 4 hours into my patrol when I got there. It was about an hour before sunset, and the campsite had been closed down earlier that day as per our policy, as the snow is coming soon, and we don't want anybody getting trapped in there without proper equipment. This was right next to the lake where I had my sighting. The lake itself is fantastic in the spring when everything is warm and all the wildlife is all around. It's great. I just happened to be looking around at the right moment and saw movement from the lake. That's when I saw it. At first, I saw a head. But then it came into focus, and that's when I nearly fell out of my seat. What came up from the lake was not a turtle or fish. It was nowhere in hell a fish. It had a massive flat snout with gills on each side of its face, and it appeared to have a long neck as the head was directly attached to the torso, which supported 4 large flippers. It was truly a bizarre-looking creature. I didn't know what to think, but it startled me. I was sitting there in my truck when this thing came up, and all I could do was sit there in shock, watching this thing come up out of the water. It disappeared quickly, but I just sat there totally in awe. I was not even sure how to process the fact that I had just seen this large prehistoric dinosaur-looking thing pop out of the water and go back under. So I called it in, basically reporting that, well, there was nothing to report. I drove away slowly and cautiously. I don't know what that thing was, but later on, after some time, I thought I realized with all the evidence of Nessie in Scotland and so many other sightings around the world, did I have my own Loch Ness Monster sighting, or is this something else entirely? So, I was urban exploring at an abandoned phosphate mine last night located in Central Florida, and myself and a friend heard a noise I can't quite explain. For reference, this location is surrounded by nothing but farms and distant mines for like 10-15 miles, and it has been abandoned since roughly 2008. I heard the noise in question while walking down one of the roads after the sun had set. It was just me and my 3 friends when me and one of the people I was with heard it. It sounded like a retching noise mixed with a scream. It was maybe medium in pitch, but guttural. It was way too loud for us both to have imagined it. I was a park ranger as my last job, and I'm pretty familiar with the wildlife in the area. It didn't sound like anything I have heard in my time working as a ranger near that area. I also have urban explored the location multiple times prior and had a few weird experiences, but nothing like this. Anyone have any idea what I could have heard? This story took place in Texas back in the fall of 1994. I was traveling from a small town outside Dallas called Grapevine and was heading to my duty station in Lubbock, Texas. I would never take this route again after what happened this night along I-20. I was traveling alone and had left around 7 p.m. on my road trip across Texas. If you've ever been to Texas, then you know that you can drive for hours on end and still be in Texas. Anyways, this story takes place about 30 minutes outside Abilene and would change my life forever. I decided to stop at a rest stop along the highway to stretch my legs and take a piss. I noticed a woman in a late 70s Model Ford parked in the lot when I got out. I went and did my business, had a smoke, and before I left I noticed the woman still sitting in her car. So I walked over and knocked on the window, which startled her, and asked if she was okay or needed help. She smiled and said that her tire was flat and that her battery had died while she was waiting here. I asked if she had a spare tire, and she said no. I asked if anyone was coming to get her. She said that her daughter was supposed to, but it's been several hours of her waiting. I asked where she was going, and she said Abilene. So I offered to give her a ride if she wanted. She started crying and said that would be wonderful. So we start heading to Abilene and making small talk. I told her I was in the Air Force and heading to Lubbock. She said that was wonderful and hoped that I really enjoyed it. I did notice that she kept looking in the mirror, so I asked if she was okay with me giving her a ride. She smiled and said that everything was fine. She was just happy that someone stopped. So we finally get to her house in a small suburb just outside of town. She thanks me for her ride and hands me a scrap of paper with her home number on it. She asks that I call her when I get to my destination so she can know I made it safely. I thanked her and said I would, but I'd wait until the morning since I knew it would be late when I arrived in Lubbock. I arrived at Reese Affy late that night and stayed at the On Base Hotel. I got checked in and took a shower and went to bed. The next morning I got up and got dressed for the day and went to find my unit HQ. I didn't even think about the night before. I had so much to do checking squared away. It wouldn't be for another 2 weeks before I came across that scrap of paper with the number. I felt bad that I hadn't kept my promise to call, so I decided to stop what I was doing and give her a call. I called the number and a young woman answered the phone, so I asked for Sandy. The woman on the line said who, so I apologized and said maybe it was Sandra. She asked who is this, and I gave her my name and explained that I had given her a ride a couple weeks back. She said that I must be confused, and I read the number off of the paper in my hand just in case I dialed the wrong number. She said, no, I had the correct number, but I couldn't give her mother a ride home because she had passed away in the early 80s. She was apparently driving home and began having car troubles, so she stopped at a rest stop just outside of town. When she didn't make it home, her father's woman I was talking with became concerned. It was at that time there was a knock on their door and two state troopers and a local police officer were at the door. She said that a trooper saw the vehicle stopped at the rest stop and stopped to check it out. What he found and what she told me gave me chills. Her mother had been brutally assaulted and her head was bashed in. Someone has slit her tires and disconnected her battery. The worst part was that she didn't die right away, as there was bloody handprints on the window, steering wheel and shifter, like she was trying to leave. The trooper said that they didn't have any suspects, but there were times that certain motorcycle clubs would pass through at night. I described the car and what her mother looked like and what she was wearing as best as I could recall. She definitely didn't look old enough to have a daughter my age. Her daughter just started crying and asked that I not call back. A few days later, I received word to report to the squadron commander, so I headed over to our building. When I arrived, my captain called me into his office and began asking me questions about where I lived and when did I drive in and what route I took. I immediately knew something was wrong. We then went into a briefing room where my CO and a Texas Ranger and state trooper were seated. I introduced myself and took a seat. They began by asking the same questions my captain had previously asked, and why I had called the number and spoke with the woman. I explained everything as clearly and in detail as possible. They then finished taking notes, and the ranger asked who needed a smoke. So my CO excused himself, and the captain, the two officers, and myself stepped out back to the smoking area. This was when the ranger informed me that he was the trooper who had found the car back in the early 80s and that the only reason he came out today was because of the details I mentioned in my phone call to the daughter. The trooper said that they get calls about a stranded woman every so often, but when they get there, they never find anything. So in closing, be careful who you decide to help, because not everyone is what they seem. I'd like to state that the reason specific timeframes are not given is due to the personal nature of these events. Not a ranger, but forest worker in a forest underneath Brussels. We were planting trees on the outskirts of what falls under our property, hard to get there. The spot we needed to plant was in the middle of the forest. So we all go by foot, except for one who goes with the tractor and all the trees. When we arrive at the spot, we notice a big blue tarp, folded up and stuffed away near the base of a tree. Weird, I thought. How did this get here? Who goes through all this trouble to litter here? Oh well, we'll take it along with us and we can put all of it in the loader of the tractor, but first finish the job so job is finished, Day's almost over, and we gather everything to head back, and lastly off course the tarp that was left behind. We pick up the tarp, and we notice there was an army pack underneath, and worst of all, there was a barrel, like from a gun, sticking out. We were confused AF. We opened the pack to check it out, and it was an actual AK-47, discarded in the middle of the forest. Too bad the day was almost finished, as we had to call the police, and they took their time getting there. Weird, never heard anything of it again, but there must be a lot going on in that city. Not a park ranger, but I've seen some wacky shit up near Lake Powell. Two come to mid, though. The last time I was there, I was out fishing with my dad on our little boat, chilling in some little cove. I hear a noise, look up, and a giant-ass plane flies right over us. Couldn't have been more than 400 feet above us. I couldn't get any pictures or video, and I couldn't recognize the plane at all. Different trip. I was probably 7 or 8 years old, riding in the front of my dad's truck, while he is driving us back as usual. It was like 3 in the morning. I was about to pass out when I see a big shadow dart across the road. What the hell was that? I sure as hell don't know. My dad also makes a noise in surprise, and we both just kind of sit there. He asks, "You see that too?" Yeah, I sure as hell did. We both look back out to the road and see 2 bright yellow eyes off in the bushes up ahead of us. We didn't go under 60 until we reached Flagstaff. I spent a lot of time growing up in the mountains of northern Arizona. I've posted this before, but don't mind posting it again. Me and 3 friends went out late one night. I must have been 16 or 17. We would often go in deep parts of the forest and smoke weed and hang out. This time around, we decided to go to a random spot out way past where we were used to going. We were probably a good 10 miles out from an area called Doney Park in Flagstaff and found a spot super far into the woods where we could build a fire and smoke some bowls. 2 of my friends hopped out of the vehicle to take a pee while me and the other friend stayed in the car. We sat in silence for a short time before we heard tree branches snapping and the loudest crackling sound imaginable. Sounded just like the predator. We looked at each other with absolute fear and confusion in our faces. Our other 2 friends hopped into the car almost simultaneously, and we all freaked the F out and started driving back to the road. While driving through the forest, we hit maybe 50-60 on dirt roads, and we still heard branches breaking and the crackling. I was afraid for my life that night, but we finally made it back to the road and decided to call it short that night as we were all too afraid to go back into a wooded area and smoke. I've had every denier tell me what animal it was or could have been, but after researching it for years, I still have yet to come across that sound coming from any known animal native in Flagstaff, Arizona. It was truly bone-chilling. On the other side, I've spoken with natives and the answers have been mixed. I've had answers from Wendigo to Skinwalker, even witches. A lot of spooky shit happened to me in the woods before. I even heard drums that came closer and closer after stopping in between, and eventually one loud one banged right in front of us. The scariest thing is I was never alone for either of these. It involved multiple people who can retell the story word for word on how it happened. There is something strange going on in the woods of northern Arizona. I am 28 now, and this still gives me chills to this day. Not a ranger, but I came across some poor woman at Arches National Park who was stuck in the middle of the road because her car was struck by lightning. It wouldn't turn on or budge. I offered to pull her to a more safe location, but she couldn't even shift the vehicle into neutral since it wouldn't start. It took a good half hour to find a ranger to tell them because there's no cell service or phones in the park. I don't know what happened to her. I hope she was okay. In 1982, I was a seasonal firefighter from the Modoc National Forest. It's extreme in northeastern California. Rather remote, kind of near the Oregon border, up near Klamath Falls Lava Beds National Monument. Anyway, small 4-man fire crew and the boss. He lived in a little trailer adjacent to our old cabin, right on Medicine Lake. There had been this Native American fella that had been hanging around for weeks, experienced with firefighting and whatnot. He kept thinking he could get on the crew, but the protocol was such that you had to do it all in advance, and we had our little crew, all four of us, and there was no chance he could be on it, but he kind of wouldn't take no for an answer. This was the U.S. Forest Service Department of Agriculture Forest Service, small fire crew, so we're all familiar with this fella. Can't remember his name anymore, and, you know, we're up early in the morning doing the... They call them the PTS physical exercise and all. Getting ready for the day, and he's up with us again, trying to join us. And he goes, "Hey, look what I found here." And he takes us out to the edge of Medicine Lake, and there's this huge footprint, but just one. It must be 18 to 20 inches long, 6 inches wide, and it's like, okay, and then we're all, where's the next one? But yeah, the next one was down on the swampy edge of the lake. So that kind of made sense, you know, that there was only one, odd as that was. And the boss there, the crew boss, he says, "Boy, this is strange, fellas, just last night." Sometimes he'd have his little 4-year-old up there, spending the night in this trailer. He goes, "My son woke me up in the middle of the night saying, 'Daddy, Daddy, Bigfoot's out there.' He just brushed it off until a couple hours later. There was a print, and it caused enough interest everyone who was pretty skeptical, I think." It caused enough interest. We called the Big Cheese, the district ranger, they call him. An hour and a half away at Chule Lake. He comes up. An hour and a half up, 4-wheel drive, pretty rough roads, you know, one way up like that. He comes up, and he's quite interested. He's trying to take a print of it, a plaster cast. I'm watching him do this, and when I was a kid growing up, I did this stuff all the time. I'm watching. I'm thinking like that's not going to work because it was too watered down. But I was like almost a kid. I was in my young 20s. One of my first big jobs of that nature, which I continued doing, you know, most of my working life. I was too intimidated to say to the big boss man, you know, the district ranger, "Hey, you're screwing it up, pal. Put more plaster there, whatever it is," which is exactly the case. He failed to get a copy. I was 15, was at my boyfriend's house, and it was about 10:30 p.m. We were sitting on his trampoline in his backyard, which faces a small park behind his house. His yard is on a ground level about a meter 3-ish feet above the ground level the park is on, and his fence is on that lower level. So by sitting on the trampoline, we could see out into the darkness of the park, which was just slightly illuminated by his yard lights. We're talking when suddenly I feel an eerie chill like we're being watched, like something wants us to know we're being watched. I remember glancing all over the place and jumping at the smallest sounds of the night, my boyfriend laughing at me, and all before he suddenly stilled and rose up onto his knees to look at something in the park. A man is watching us from that tree. Jesus, those words still chill me to the core. I froze and asked him to tell me what he was doing. He told me that the man was very tall, almost halfway up the tree, which was a large eucalyptus we live in Queensland, Australia, and that only his head and shoulder were really visible, and that his eyes were glowing or reflecting the light from his yard lights. I wondered if he was lying and making fun of me again for being paranoid earlier, so I sat up and leaned over him to see the thing next to the tree. There it was. It was tall, darker than the shadows of the trees, and wasn't lit up like the trees were from the lights. Its eyes were shining brightly, and it was exceptionally tall. Couldn't be a man if not for the shoulder and arm draped over the tree, and so was not an animal either. I fell back onto the trampoline, and my boyfriend told me to be quiet and to start moving back towards the house. It was moving towards us. I shook my head. I did not want to move. I couldn't bring myself to move. I was frozen in fear. I don't know, but I remember he had to force me up, swearing loudly and telling me it was nearly at the fence. I got up and caught a glance of a figure nearly across the short distance from the trees to his yard and booked it to the stairs up to his front door. I glanced back to look again and BF yelled not to. that it was climbing over the fence, and I somehow moved even faster and made it to the door without tripping up the stairs and breaking a leg. He told me again. It had been trying to climb over the fence when I slowed down to take a look. His family is very religious, and his father swears it was a demon trying to test their faith or some bullshit, but I don't think it was. Had another encounter maybe a month later when my boyfriend told me a figure was watching me from the exposed ceiling beams of my old barn-like house during a FaceTime call late at night. Maybe a shadow man. Maybe an Australian version of a skinwalker. I am 19 now, and I still can't stop thinking about what happened. If anyone knows what this sort of aggressive, stalker behavior means, and what creature this was, please let me know. It was definitely not just some creepy man. This shadowy thing was at least 3 meters tall, 9-ish feet, and had bright glowing white eyes. I am originally from Muncie, Indiana, and grew up spending a lot of time at Prairie Creek, because my family has a boat there. It was the summer of 27 when we took a boat ride and watched the sunset. It was dusk, and the sun was setting as we approached our dock. As we got closer, my friend and I both saw what looked like a human standing at the end of our dock and thought it was strange because there was no one else around. Our neighboring boats were all docked. There were no other cars around, etc. We were the only one out that evening from our dock area. It then turned around and we saw its glowing yellowish eyes. At this point, we were freaked out wondering what this was because there was something totally off about it and it was clearly not a normal human. Then, as we got even closer, it spread its wings, flapped a few times, and soared up into the sky. It was way too big to be a bird. I've never seen anything like it before or after. It was probably around 5-6 feet tall and really dark. The whole body and wings were gray or black. Not sure if this is of interest, but my family and I also saw a UFO at Prairie Creek Reservoir around dusk as well a few years later. We were one of the only boats on the water. It was such a serene, quiet, and peaceful evening. My mother looked up at the sky and saw the UFO, so we all looked up. It was shaped like a tin can, stayed still, and made absolutely no noise. At that instant, my father caught a fish, and the commotion caused us all to look down, and a few seconds later, when we looked back up, it was gone without a trace. I had something happen to me when I was an over-the-road truck driver in very rural Arkansas. I was a trainer, and at about 2 o'clock in the morning, my student woke up, came through the curtain, and sat in the other seat. I said, "What are you doing up?" And he said, "Just all of a sudden, I just couldn't sleep." Right about then, I looked up, and it was very rural, and there were no cars parked along the road, no houses, just forest. And somebody standing on the white line on the freeway, you know, on the side of the road. I clicked the cruise control off and I slowed down. I started to move over into the left lane, and there was a guy in a black suit and a black fedora hat. He was just standing there, still looking out onto the freeway. It was really strange, and I have tried over the years to rationalize what that was, and I haven't been able to. There was just nothing around out there. Nothing. The really strange part was, I was kind of freaked out and kind of scared about it. But my student, he was like, "Maybe we should stop and see if he's okay." I said, "I'm not stopping." He was really insistent that we stop, and I finally said, "When we get about 2 miles down the road, I'll pull over. I'll wait about an hour. If you're not back, I'm leaving." He kind of hushed up then. He had this crazy sense that he needed to go to this person. I felt the opposite, that I needed to get the hell out of there. It was strange. I haven't told too many people, but yeah, really odd. He was looking straight off into the freeway, and he didn't really move, and the only way I can describe it, how he looked, was kind of like Agent Smith of the Matrix, you know, in the suit like that. But he was also wearing the old-style fedora hat, MIB. I thought maybe he was drunk at a wedding party and lost, but there was nothing out there. There was no reason for anybody to be standing out there, especially in a suit. The Monday before last, which I believe was the 19th of March, I was driving from the Noble Square area of Chicago, somewhat on the north side to the southwest side of the city, to stop by my parents' house. This was around noon, and as I was getting onto I-94, the expressway at the Milwaukee on-ramp, I was cut off by a fire truck and ambulance as they were going to tend to an accident. And as such, I ended up sitting in accident traffic, where I literally just put the car in park and just sat. And as I sat there, all of a sudden, there was this black, somewhat triangular, as if it was a low pyramid. A low, wide pyramid started hovering from the left of my view, which was near the skyline, was over the expressway, and eventually out of sight to the right. But it went back and forth quite a few times. I originally assumed it was a kite or a balloon. The kite part, though, just doesn't work because there's nowhere for someone to stand and control it. Perhaps it was a kite that got away, but it was moving in a controlled fashion. It was completely black. I thought I noticed a glint of light off of it, a couple of times, like it was something metallic reflecting, which made me think it was Mylar. If it was just a Mylar balloon, but again, it was moving in such a controlled way, it really kind of started tripping me out. Of course, you can't really gauge size in situations like that. We know that. But it seemed huge, especially compared to some of the lake gulls or birds that were flying somewhat in the same vicinity. What really tripped me out, though, in the end, and this was a good 30 seconds of staring at this, maybe a little less than that, was when I realized it was hovering right over this car accident. And with everything you hear about the Silver Bridge collapse and all the stuff in Point Pleasant, it made the hair on my arms stand up. I'll be very honest. I don't know that anything was truly Mothman-ish, but I wonder if it wasn't a drone of some sort and if had more to do with the person or persons who have been hoaxing this. I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea what it actually was, but it certainly did trip me out. To a degree, I consider myself a very rational person, a thoughtful person, and again, very skeptical, so I have trouble accepting that it was a flying humanoid cryptid hovering over an accident scene, but I don't know what to make of it, you know. I'm hoping that maybe somebody else has seen this, that somebody else has a conclusive explanation. Again, this was Monday before last, so I believe that was the 19th of March, right after St. Patrick's Day, a couple of days after. It was right around probably 12:30 p.m. afternoon. It was pretty sunny out, a little windy, which is probably an important fact to note, but again very black with possibly a glint of light that was reflecting off of it, as if there was something metallic or shiny on it. When it caught the sun, it seemed to glint at least twice that I noticed. And again, it was kind of a low, wide pyramid shape. I would hazard to guess that it was a balloon, but who knows? I'm in South Florida now, but I spent most of my life in Pennsylvania. We were at an out-of-the-way area along Racetown Lake in Huntingdon County, and we would be camping out, and we weren't looking for Bigfoot. It was spring 2022. I didn't even know there was a Bigfoot. We were looking for firewood. It was about 2 in the morning, and long story short, we saw this creature in the water, and it looked like it was fishing. You know, like feeling around with your hand, like people who catch catfish with their hands. It is called noodling. It looked like it was doing that, and it was just doing things that weren't normal. At first, we thought it was a person, but it was a real mucky bottom. It's a backwater on early morning. It's like 3 or 4 feet deep, and it would go all the way down, so just like only his nostrils would be out. He'd stay there for 2-3 minutes, then stand up and move around. We soon realized it wasn't a person. I went down to get a closer look, and when I got down to the water's edge, and it stood up, it was so huge and massive, and I couldn't tell, you know, it was a creature. I couldn't see distinct details, but it was a really large creature, and it was like a man. I strained to get a better look because I couldn't believe what I was looking at, and I was probably like 40 feet from it. I was kind of hiding behind some brush and stuff. I stepped on a twig, and in an instant, it headed out of the water, probably 30 feet from shore, and in a mucky mud environment. In 3-4 feet of water, you'd usually strain and struggle to get out of that water. It just moved out like it was a bird skimming the water. Just instantly, it was out of the water and on the bank. When it reached shore, it quickly walked into the forest, It had two large fish, looked like catfish, by the mouth in each hand. I was looking to try and make some friends. Stupid teenager me posted in the platonic section to try and see if maybe someone wanted to chat. I was also very lonely. A guy answered, about 34 or so. Great, we start chatting, some mutual interests. No intention of ever taking it anywhere, sexual or into the physical world. One day he tells me that I'm attractive, huh, and that I'm his sex slave now. I protest, and he responds with texting me, do you want me to kill your entire family? I know where you live, where you go to school. I can kill you in a heartbeat. Of course, this scared the F out of 17-year-old me. He had a list of demands, all seemingly simple. Write this on your body with eyeliner, send a picture of it, etc. Nothing I couldn't handle. I complied, scared out of my mind. He told me to create an ad for the hookup section and essentially act as a prostitute for him. He wanted me to write prices on my chest and rob anyone who didn't comply. I had sex with some of the people that he told me I should do, but I never did any money exchange and just planned to pay this creep out of my savings. It got worse from there. He was obviously manipulative, and one day he told me to send him pictures. I was pretty decent at image manipulation, so I positioned myself in a way to make it look like I was naked. He was pleased, and I went back to completely wearing my pants. Later, he wanted a pic of something else, and my dumbass forgot the previous no-pants rule. He forced me on camera to take a knife to my knees until they bled, then kneel on the carpet. I was reaching my breaking point, and he sensed that. He upped his threats, describing in detail how he would lock me in a closet and use me as a S-slave at parties, how he would arm me nonstop and make me watch as he killed those I loved. One day he pushed it too far. He asked what I was doing, and I mentioned that I was babysitting my 3-year-old cousin. He asked, nay, demanded that I take dirty pictures of her and send them to him. Demanded that I molest her on camera. I filled out an anonymous police report, sent screenshots, and blocked him on everything. I do not know what happened. I don't know if the reports were ever investigated or if he was arrested. I just know that he's out of my life, the police were alerted, and I'm safe. I never really had a horror story, but a few odd ones. I was selling a mini bike. Got all the usual. Thing is garbage. I'll give you the $20 it's worth in scrap if you bring it to me BS. It was taking a while to sell, so I went to look to make sure it was priced competitively. I listed it 2 or 3 times, but noticed one of the ads for mine was almost twice as much. That's odd. I don't see how I made that typo. Then I notice it's from a couple towns over, and the description is tweaked a little. I sent the guy an email asking a few questions about it, specifically things on it that are in my pictures he copied, into his ad, and he BS'd some pretty good answered, but stopped replying when I asked for more pics. I have no clue what his end game with that was. Another is from a couple years back when people still used tube TVs before Goodwill and Salvation Army even refused to take donated ones. My parents had a half-decent one but upgraded to a flat screen. I put the old CRT TV on Craigslist for $30 or so. Not too many good offers, one guy wants it, gives a sob story about his girlfriend with fibromyalgia needing it, and even though the ad specified pickup only, he can't do the half-hour drive. So I'm working near him and agree to meet up with him. He haggles me down to $20. Whatever. The night before I ask if we're still on, he claims to only have $15 to his name till the first of the month and asks will that be good enough, or he can throw in his girlfriend's old black and white TV as a partial trade. Fine, I just want the thing gone at this point. I wake up at 5 a.m. to load this beast into my car before work, then text him that afternoon to let him know I'm getting off work to head to the place we agreed to meet. He replies with, sorry, got a better deal from someone. And another that's not a horror story. I bought a Nitro RC car off someone that supposedly only needed a small clip to get running. $100 in parts later, I still couldn't get it to run right, so I decided to cut my losses and sell or trade it to someone who knew what they were doing. Found someone who agreed to trade me a tablet for it, what I was looking for. I got his life story leading up to his engagement, his fiance leaving him, him finding an Amazon gift card she left behind, and him blowing it on a tablet he didn't need and hence now it's up for trade. Whatever, I didn't have anywhere to be. He brought his collection of functioning RCs he already had to the gas station we agreed to do the trade at, and we spent almost an hour ripping around one of them around the parking lot then. I don't remember what it was, but the thing was at least 3 feet long and an absolute beast. I was trying to get away from this money pit hobby and went home tempted to spend 10+ more to get a badass functioning RC. Last summer, I was in a really bad place. I had just moved back to my hometown only to have my original plans for everything, including living arrangements, fall through. I had no job, and with an art degree, an impossibly hard time finding one. I was struggling and often didn't have enough money to eat or take the bus. I have a chronic stomach issue that leaves me bedridden sometimes, and I was having a flare-up and stuck at a friend's house. I missed my bus the night before and slept at her house. She left for work at 4 a.m., so I stayed at her place until the morning, but didn't realize the buses don't run in that neighborhood on weekends. I had already locked myself out of her apartment, so I had about a 7-mile walk home, but it was over 100 degrees and I was sick to my stomach. In a moment of desperation, I made a public post on a blog I had at the time linking my Venmo and asking for a few bucks to get an Uber home. Not even an hour after I made the post, I got $100 out of nowhere on Venmo from a photographer that was actually texting me the day before about a possible shoot. I am very short, so I'll never have a very successful modeling career, but I have worked with a few smaller clothing companies. Whenever I'm strapped for cash, oftentimes I can get $100 here or there taking on small modeling gigs. Nothing ever weird lull, just Etsy shops and independent clothing companies and stuff. I hadn't answered his messages because there was already something weird. He emailed me responding to me posting on Craigslist asking for general day work, like helping to set up for an event or handing out flyers. He said he recognized my email from the modeling website Model Mayhem. I have not been active on there since 2015 when I was 20. He remembered my email from a modeling profile on an account I haven't touched for 5 years. I am by no means a famous or well-known face. Along with the money, there was a message about just wanting to help me, and he can stay a kind stranger if I'm still not interested in working with him. I immediately felt guilty and like I'd misjudged him, so I responded thanking him and told him I would be willing to model for his store. He owned an online vintage clothing line that was successful on Etsy. He asked me to come to the studio for a shoot the next day in the evening, which worried me, but he said he knew I had a long bus trip ahead of me. The shoot was super weird. He had me pick what I was going to model, and it was all unsorted bulk vintage stuff in a huge bin. Most of it was unwearable. When he photographed me in each outfit, he was not concerned with getting good product shots and just trying to make me smile to boost my confidence. By the end of it was he was saying weird shit, like telling me what a perfect, pure human being I was. He ordered me an Uber home and later Venmoed me for the shoot. He totally overpaid me. The photos were never used and the clothes were never listed, but he sent me tons of the photos with captions about how nice he thought my smile was. He texted me again the next day saying that he was sad to hear about what a hard time I'd been having and told me if I ever was short on money to come by the warehouse where all the clothes and everything were and he'd pay me to do some typing. He would take the measurements on clothes that were going to be listed and I was entering them into Excel as he read them out loud. We'd do this for a couple hours and then I'd go home. But every single time he would say weirder things. Always just over-complimenting me and projecting this weird, pure virgin persona onto me. He started obsessing over my laugh and smile specifically. One time he asked me to come in to type, and it was actually a trick to go on a surprise outing for my birthday. I had told him before I showed up that I was really sick and weak that day. When I realized there was actually no work for me to do and that he was taking me to an expensive dinner, I felt horrible. I tried to go and smile through it, but I was in a lot of pain and just wanted to go home. After the restaurant, I started to walk towards the train station, but then he told me there was one more thing we had to do. We walked into an arcade bar, and he got about $20 worth of quarters and dragged me around insisting that we had to use all the quarters. He kept saying stuff like, "I'm sorry you're in such horrible pain. I can tell you feel awful. I feel so selfish for making you do this," but then making me stay longer. I finally got to go home, but I really needed the money for typing that day, and instead I got home in a ton of pain and out a few dollars in bus money. I know at this point it seems like there's no way I couldn't see his creepy feelings for me, but I'm 25 and this guy was almost 40 and constantly insisting that he was just here to help as a friend and not expecting anything in return. I was in such a bad position that I had to ignore a lot of the weirdness and didn't see any danger yet. The next time he had me type stuff out, he offered me an official job in the warehouse. I jumped on this because I'd been applying to jobs for months with no luck and was even more desperate. He immediately was hurt by me accepting the offer, saying if I worked for him, he'd have to be less friendly with me because we'd be working with other employees in the room. This, of course, made me very happy. He decided that meant I cared more about making money than our friendship. It turned into about an hour of me sitting there while he said, unfortunately exact phrasing, that I was his personal Jesus, and he was looking to me to restore his faith in humanity. When I started working, he would constantly separate me from the two other girls that I worked in the warehouse with. When we were away from them, he told me horribly personal things about them that I knew they wouldn't want shared, and he made stuff up about them to try and get me to not like them and not want to spend time with them. He was constantly comparing me to them, always referring to them as jackals, and that I'm good and they're bad. He had some really concerning feelings about all of the women in his life. He also specifically had a thing for small brown girls. Me and the two other girls I worked with had very similar looks, and all his exes looked creepily similar to us. All the models on the side as well. He would tell me wildly inappropriate stories all day, and every time we worked together, it was just him inching closer to me and me squirming away to the point where we'd wind up across the room, because he kept moving closer, and I kept backing up. He'd complain that it seemed like he disgusted me. I started hating and dreading coming in to deal with him so much that I could no longer fake a good mood. He would interrogate me about why I wasn't smiling or giggling or bubbly. Like literally interrogate me to the point where no work would get done because he'd be trying to force me to act happy, and then trying to do things to make me happier, like buying me a coffee that I didn't want. The final straw came after working for him for maybe 3 weeks. We often had to move clothes on racks between the studio and the warehouse for shoots. While we were walking down the street with the clothes, he started asking me if I'd ever heard of incels. I tried to avoid any topic that can be led back to sex with him, so I just said that I didn't want to think about that at the moment. He started to get upset. I elaborated that I knew someone killed in the Ook Santa Barbara shooting, and that it wasn't an easy topic for me. That wasn't enough for him either. He started to get worked up. After we got to the warehouse, he tried to pull me away from my work to take me out for a coffee, just me and him, even though the other co-workers were there. I told him no thanks, and he tried to quietly say it was so we could talk. I knew this meant he wanted to pull me away from them to privately interrogate me about why I wasn't smiling and why I wouldn't talk about incels with him. I played dumb and said in my cheeriest voice, "Can't we talk here?" I think in that moment he realized I was onto his shit. He just said okay, while nodding his head in the most dejected way and walking out to get coffee on his own. Later on, I was supposed to be sorting clothes onto a rack by myself for a shoot the next day, while he worked on a shoot in the studio with the two other employees. I decided I was going to quit in that moment. I waited for them to all be gone. Did the job quickly, he Venmo'd me at the end of every day for my hours instead of actually having me on payroll. He lied and said he was enrolling me, but had no intention of ever doing it, and texted him that I was leaving 5 minutes early for my bus. He usually paid me as I was walking to the train. This time it took hours for him to send, and it was only half of what he usually paid me. He literally punished me by paying me less. As soon as he paid me, I texted him explaining that his behavior was getting more and more frightening and that I didn't feel safe working with him. I told him I quit and to not attempt to contact me. He began calling immediately. I blocked him and I got calls from different phone numbers over and over throughout the next day that wouldn't stop no matter how many of them I blocked. A couple weeks later, I got a bunch of comments from a throwaway account on my Instagram pictures calling me evil and saying a bunch of weird personal things. I could tell it was him. I also never noticed he'd left voicemails because the way my old phone was set up was stupid. But when I switched phones, I realized he'd completely filled my box up. I listened to a few, and they were so scary. One of them was him singing, "Just a nice guy, just a normal guy," for about 4 minutes straight. Another was him singing about how I'm evil. Some were just incoherent rambling and ranting and crying. Now I have a new number and all of my social media is on complete lockdown. This guy boasts about holding grudges for years, so I expect him to obsess and attempt to mess with me for a very long time.